review with engineer Ronald Creel on March 7th, 2005.
Hello, Ron. This is Anthony Young calling from Florida. I'm doing okay. You asked me to give you a call about this afternoon.
Yeah.
And I'm glad I had an opportunity. Am I calling you at work then?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't want to take too much of your time, but I appreciate you giving me some attention here. I've been reading your document on the thermal program you were involved with, and it's really extensive. In fact, I think the space I'll be able to dedicate to it won't even approach this, but what I want to try to do is, I think I've pretty much explained to you the general scope of my book. I really don't know too much about yours.
Well, in fact, I may or may not ever get to really do that. I'm awful busy, and I was at a conference.
Oh, is this like an online type of...
Well, whether it be online is debatable still, because what you run into is that speeds of machines and different things, being the quote of being online may be counterproductive to what we want to do. There's a trade-off there.
Right.
You know what I mean? As to, and as far as distribution and being able to, well, I have a goal there that we want it to be put out for the school's uses and all, and then what you run into is everybody doesn't have the same kind of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
There's all kinds of trades when you're doing something like that. So we're working on it. I've got it outlined, and I've got some team members. I'm kind of really amazed nowadays at what these guys can do with three-dimensional software and different tools that they have as compared to what we did back in our day.
Well, you know, you've got finite element analysis software. I'm sure you got thermal analysis software. There's so many different things.
Well, it's improved, and even what this program would do, what this simulation would do, is it tries to match up clearly. The President's Space Policy Commission clearly recommended. Got another call coming?
Oh no, that's a home phone. I'm on a different line. That, you know, that's absolutely right, because I'm glad they touched on that, because I think it's been lost for a couple of decades now, and you've got to fire the imagination, and I think the program you're talking about, it can be one of the ways to do that.
Oh, yeah, that's why I'm spending most of my time on it, but up till now, I was kind of two-pronged in that I was out kind of having this cathartic, what I call my cathartic presentation to different folks, kind of say,
mm-hmm.
We didn't close off the Apollo program that well, and thusly, the void there, a vacuum that needs to have people tell what we did and how we did it. And so that's why I did my presentation. And then I got off, like I said, kind of talking to these other guys. They said, hey, you ought to write a book. And I said, well, that's an interesting idea, but I don't know if I'll ever have time to do it. So that's why I was kind of interested in participating with you feeding you some information there, as long as you give me credit for it, and would
I would be most happy to do that, because
I guess what I'm saying is, and I understand that the strategy of your document, would it be a kind of like a three-pronged effort? You talk the moon rovers that we had, us and the Russians, as well as, well, maybe two-pronged, and then you're going to talk about the Mars.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity those. And by the way, I do have some contacts. I've been up to Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I have a council with them up about some thoughts they have about doing a renewed effort here. I have some clear opinions of my own, as you see in the presentation there, that we certainly had a lot of trouble with dust, lunar dust.
Yeah, I've been watching the spacecraft films DVD sets on Apollo 15 and 17. And even when the ground was telling them to keep a mind of the dust on top of the radiator covers, because the darkness of the soil would actually heat up the.
That's true. It was what we really had was, and I try to explain it to people, was that we had a situation there where it frustrated us. Frustrated us at the time, it's frustrated me for decades here, that the testing we did, it's not like we didn't test a lot of those effects before we went.
Mm-hmm.
The problem we got is, testing them here on the Earth, you might almost call it false testing. You've got to be awfully careful here. It's a different world up there, a different environment.
Absolutely it is.
And so all the things that we tried to do, we found out that we didn't understand it. So as we contemplate going back, we've got to clearly set out a method whereby we can get correlated, believable test results here on the Earth, such as get to any kind of belief that once you got back up there, that you could cope with the adverse effects. I'm not totally convinced that it's not just so harsh an environment and the dust gets into everything and onto everything, that it's going to be tough. It's going to be, what do we call it, the number one issue. By the way, John Young, Apollo 16
mm-hmm.
driver, I made my presentation in Las Vegas back in the summertime,
mm-hmm.
and on a Friday, he got up on a Saturday and said exactly the same thing. He said dust was the number one concern.
Yes.
To him, he's also concerned about health issues.
Yes.
That going beyond just our trouble we have with our getting on our radiators, but he's more concerned with health issues and the fact that, but in our case, yeah, the dust, even though we got it on variously different missions, by Apollo 17, we got the crew a little bit more attuned, and they were a little better about cleaning off our dust covers before they raised them up. We had covers that covered the radiators, and the intent was to keep the dust off. So they did a little bit better job. We had a bad scenario, a bad scene happening to us on both Apollo 16 and 17 that they unfortunately knocked off a fender extension.
Yes.
On the rear.
Yes. That was disastrous.
It's almost like Murphy was riding with us and he said, hey, I mean, how could you predict that? You know, that on Apollo 16 it happened and our batteries ran hot. We had to turn one off and we had a whole series of things going on there. And then we went down and talked to them and they got better at it, but then had this bad happenstance of actually catching the hammer on the suit under the lip of that fender extension, knocking it off in the same exact place. At least on Apollo 17 they did go back in and we did work at kind of a scenario there to come back out and to use some lunar maps to do a fix.
Yes.
Pictures that are in the
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. They did that. That helped. And a little bit better, but we were certainly frustrated that we were requiring them to spend as much time as we were to clean the covers off or to clean the radiators off of that radar, or try to clean off the radiators.
Mm-hmm.
So it was frustrating to us to be in that mode and on something that we ultimately could not control. Clearly, they'd brush them off, and they'd say, hey, we brushed them off, but they weren't getting them clean, and it wasn't their fault.
Mm-hmm.
It was just it's a different world up there, and the way that it does behave.
You did, well, of course, you didn't even have air to convect any heat away at all.
No, it's a very, very hard vacuum, and almost, it's beyond what vacuums, by the way, that we can simulate here on the Earth.
Is that right?
That's right, that is true. We best we can do on the Earth here is generally about what we've done in what's called TORS, our measurement of the pressure, and we can generally get down in the 10 to minus 8, 10 to minus 9 region. As TOR, I think, has to do with how few interatomic particles you have.
Isn't that something?
It's such a total
vacuum up there, isn't that?
The total vacuum of the moon is 10 to minus 14.
I see.
So there's a gap there that says you've gotten it pretty good in the testing. And various for other, but for little bell jars, smaller little volumes, they can pump out a little better. You can get down 10 to minus 10, 10 to minus 11, maybe 12. Problem is, you get up these bigger pressure down. There's just a limit to what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
And then think about it. Doing dust type experiments and trying to do tests with dust is counterproductive to having the vacuum operate also. It's all more difficult.
Yes.
Because you've entered in some particles that are there. So it's going to be a challenge.
Because basically, in the future, they'll have to simulate these conditions also, not just a pure environment within a vacuum, but the pollution of the dust on there as well. But it will have to be at 1G, and you're right.
That's true. You've got the factor of it is, you've hit upon a key point there. It's the fact that you can't get the atmosphere down as low pressure as you had up there, the lack of atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
Combined with the gravity, whether or not there's any gravity effects, a lot of people think, I've got these meetings, they've got a lot of theories about things, and I'm just saying, hey guys, what we've proven is if we don't understand it, we've got to get better at trying to understand it, or what we honestly, after things were over with, we sat there, after Apollo 17,
mm-hmm.
we'd had these difficulties, and we sat there, my mentor at the time, he's passed away now, but his name is Hugh Campbell, and in fact, I dedicate the last page in my presentation, I dedicate to him and to my wife, because my wife certainly put up with me, my bride at the time, put up with me having to be away from
him. A lot of spouses went through this.
So I've got a picture of her in there.
Yes, I saw. It was great.
Sitting on the claw unit. She doesn't like that picture because it's 70s.
It's style. Just so 70s, right.
The big hairdo and the boots and the miniskirt. It definitely is almost like it's off the Laugh-In show.
It's funny. Nobody saw anything wrong with it. It was the fashion of the day, you know.
And how fashions go. They go
sure.
From now. They come in and out along that line. Nowadays, if you watch them do them from runways and the fashion show.
Well, you touched on something, and I wanted to mention this because it's rare that I have an opportunity. I'm just starting on this thing now. This is my first month. I'm giving myself about 12 months to work on this. There are so many veterans that worked on Apollo that never recorded their experiences, and now they're gone. And also at the end of the program, nobody thought to document so much of their experiences like you've done here. This is priceless here, because this will be passed on to future engineers who are, legacy engineers who can pass on their knowledge to a new generation that are coming up to work on new systems. It's a rare happenstance, so I'm glad you're doing this and the program you're talking about.
And not only that, I have been at the Marshall Space Flight Center. They've started up what they call their Lunar Data Mining Project.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of that is to try to capture with the few of us that are still around. And I went in December, and they did a two-hour interview with me, taped, in which it was kind of like a scripted out. They tried to absorb what you've seen in that presentation and reformat and ask some questions about, say, for example, they asked me a question about, we're thinking about going back up the moon. We're going to do these robotic missions, and they can be used as a test platform for things like maybe this dust problem. And I said, wait a minute. You guys don't understand here. Even the robotic missions have got to work right the first time. There is no room for failure in any of these procedures, in any processes. Any minor problems or failures you've got, the result of those is cancellation of your program.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the case of when you got men involved. Now, granted, with the robotic missions they may do early on, you've at least got the advantage if you don't have the men. We didn't have that luxury. We had the men. Involved in hence everything we did, we had to have infinite number of backup procedures worked out. We'd had to test things, much more severely than what we'd expect to see them. All those things are geared toward the fact that, and so I'll give an example, what I got the Super Snoopy Award for was justified, and I'm proud of it, but it wasn't like I did it to get the award. But what we had was our thermal models. Thermal models, the one we had of the rover, which we'd correlated and built up from doing testing, and then you do your model kind of in parallel where you match up, what test results you did. And when we got ready for Apollo 15, it was essentially, it was too cumbersome, it was too large, too cumbersome. And back in those days, I'm amazed. I get off these side subjects, but I get amazed about the computer capabilities. I can run here that particular model I have on the rover, and I'll reprogram it in, and I can run it literally a whole scenario of a driving period and a cool down period when they went back in, you know, inside to rest. And I can do that whole nearly a full day's worth in about as quick as I hit the enter button on the laptop.
Isn't that something?
Back.
Yeah.
Compared to back in our day, with these large, these models and all, would take 20, 30 minutes or maybe longer.
Mm-hmm.
An hour to do a run like that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That frustrated us, but it also frustrated us that we didn't understand the phenomenon and the fact that it was hurting us and we were just limping along.
But wasn't it also a factor, Ron, that you had such little time to engineer this vehicle that wouldn't you have liked to have 36 months to engineer this vehicle?
To a certain extent, although I don't think it would have helped in this arena with the dust, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because of safety issues. I think they're going to continue to be that way. That you can get away from that, there's not... I was out, I help out, I'll be helping out again here. In fact, I don't know if there's room in the book or something to say something about, but NASA has a moon buggy race in Huntsville.
I've seen the website for that. They have it every year, don't they?
Yeah, they do. I'm helping.
I'd like to put a sidebar in the book on that, like a one page that describes all this. So
yeah, that would be good. And see, I got some mean things to say, but I just what you've seen there is, what I think you see is the other thing that I've tried to focus in on people is that they're a little nearsighted. That we had already started thinking about a dual mode rover. There were four rovers built, by the way. A lot of people don't know that. The contract was for four of them, and we only flew three. The fourth one, I don't think ever got fully constructed.
Oh, now this is new information for me.
That's new information for you. Yep. And in fact, in this process, I have tried here to ferret out with the folks at Smithsonian about where these different pieces and parts are, because take for example the rover you saw in the document. That's the qual unit, the one that my wife's sitting on.
Yes.
It's a flight-like article, which we essentially took and put through much, much greater testing environments. Because your flight units, you put them through acceptance level testing, and you don't want to take them to the full limit.
To almost to destructive testing, right. You don't want to do that.
And hence put it in the big vacuum chamber up in Seattle. So, and then we'd open the covers and we'd get cooled, a good cool down, you know. We went to had gotten good cool down and gotten good behavior out of the system. But when we got up to the moon, we were fighting that losing battle all along, compounded by the fact, as I mentioned earlier, that the vendors were, the extensions were lost in the breeder. And,
you know, those things were really the Achilles heel on the whole rover, and I don't think anybody anticipated that.
Yes, some people might say, well, why didn't you test, why didn't you try to prevent this at all? How do you prevent it? I don't know the answer to that.
Right.
It's, and it wasn't just us. All radiators were running hot. Everything was running hot. TV camera, the communication unit up front.
Well, yeah, the whole thermal program wasn't just batteries. It was the drive motors for the wheels. Oh, I see.
So,
okay.
So well, we were fully expecting that since the drive system, suspension, wheel, motor, and all that was going to be directly in contact with the men, that it was going to be dust covered. And we were fully ready for that and tested. So we were in pretty good shape. Max temperature on the motors, as I show in there, was about 270 on the last mission, which drove a little bit further, but still well below the any problem on the motor temperatures. But on that model, I was telling you, back to my point there, but that our models were so cumbersome for Apollo 15, we weren't able to run them in real time. We had to run them in the night period in between when they were back resting. Well, we did some before they landed, and then once we got updated, you know, we'd run with that big model, we found that it was too cumbersome. So that's what I was assigned to take that bigger model and boil it down into the Semper model that you see in there. Simple model that could actually be run in real time.
Mm-hmm.
It could be run both in the practice and the preparation periods when they were back inside. In other words, after you finished the first EVA, they went back inside and we had to get all the runs together saying, hey, here's what temperatures we had. Now take it from that point and extrapolate, you know, what's going to happen the next day, all the traverses, and then put that in. So we came about with a pretty good situation. But in that model, we essentially, since the motors had run so cool, and said, hey, don't even put the motors into that simulation. It's only a simulation of the forward, what we call the forward chassis area, with those radiators and the battery. that's what we worked on, and it was a good challenge at the time. You're right, we didn't necessarily document that well. I have scanned in. You can see there on Eric's Lunar Surface Journal page. I did scan in the 1972 mobility document, what I call the Lunar Mobility.
Yes, I've got that also. Mm-hmm.
But you're right about these they'll be trying to get to the folks, because they did an excellent job. When you think about it, that they didn't have a whole lot of information about how the soil to wheel interaction would work.
Yes,
they had to go through and build up soil simulants as well as mm-hmm. old testing systems. Did a tremendous amount of work both in Huntsville there and at the Waterways Experiment Station, the Corps of Engineers has over in Vicksburg, Mississippi. Some of the movies of that testing, as well as you see some of the documentation in that particular document about how they went about working these. There's two great advances here, two that were done for the rover that I view besides our factor, our thermal control system. Yeah, we had a few little items in there that were interesting. Use of wax boxes, a few mass tanks to store energy while they were driving, as well as some very fancy thermal straps. Electronics into the batteries. The batteries were a big, good heat sink for us.
Now, they were built by Eagle Pitcher, right?
Yes, yes. Eagle mm-hmm. Pitcher was a battery contractor, right? And that was our basic philosophy, was to take the big mass there and the batteries and use those as a sink. Although you'll see one unit in there, the drive control electronics, it wasn't linked. It was too far away. We didn't have heat pipes back in those days.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm not sure the heat pipes necessarily are the great advantage either. Heat pipes are a little difficult. I do work with a lot of other systems, but the point is that I got too many thoughts there. But back to the major advances were the wire mesh wheel.
Yes.
And the other was the and I've just talked last week here with the gentleman that was the big force behind how the rover was folded up and secured and then deployed. The deployment. Originally, the thinking was to try to make it be fully automatic, but they found that they could not manage it in a repeatable fashion all the dynamics that was going on.
Mm-hmm.
So they went to the more step-through phased approach that you see in there, managing the dynamics in a more controlled manner. And so they.
And who was that gentleman?
His name is Roy Runkle.
Roy Runkle.
Right. And a lot of what you'll find is most all everybody else is retired. I was young at the time, but most everybody else is retired. And some have other, maybe physical difficulties of their own and or with their family members. So it's not real direct to get at them, to talk to them and all. It's just a fact of life that
mm-hmm.
has gone on. And time sometimes, well, that's an example I know of several gentlemen who've passed away. And by the way, there were ladies too. As we get more into this, I don't know if you want to. It's an area that I don't want necessarily to have publicized that much because it gives credence to it, and that is the fact that there is what I call the LRV imposter, a fellow that never even worked on the program, and yet we found that he's in social studies books claims that he invented it, and he did not. And it really upsets me and the other.
I think I have come across it. Something of an urban legend kind of thing, and
it is a sad story.
Believe me, I've written 9 books, and I have a little saying, Ron, once it's in print, it's forever. And believe me, everybody I interview gets a hard copy of the particular chapter where they're quoted or whatever. I think it'd be helpful if you read everything that is related to it, so you can verify what I've got,
because I've got involved. A guy interviewed me for a New Scientist magazine. Got behind in his deadlines, and I never could get that final thing of it. In a way, I can understand what he was saying. When you're saying, well, he does his reporting, and then he has to put it out, and he didn't really want me to review it. I said, well, wait a minute. I've seen too many times, like what you just said there, where things didn't get put down exactly the right way.
Man, I never release anything to my editor or publisher without the principals I've interviewed getting to review it.
Oh, yeah, that's the way to go, because I didn't get to see the final version of what he put out, but I tried. try to at least talk like I'm talking to you and say, hey, yeah, I'm willing to participate, but I don't want to be misquoted, and I want to clear up some common misconceptions. And one of them was this urban legend guy like you're talking about in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.